rereading Bram Stoker's Dracula at the moment, and I came across a passage which I just found very powerful and very profound. And when I thought about it a little bit more, I realized that it slots into the wider sort of cultural space that Dracula occupies. Of course, today, Dracula is a just seen as a horror icon. He with a sort of demonic thing. We don't really know how to do horror anymore. But if you go back to the original Dracula book and some of the thoughts and ideas into it, it's something that actually resonates with me quite a lot, which I'll come to later. But it is, if you put it in the context of this late romanticism, it all begins to make a lot more sense. And I am aware, though, that there's if you go to the Wikipedia page on Dracula, on Bram Stoker's Dracula, there's a lot of red flags. There's people are saying that it's a anti-Semitic trope, and then more modern, which for reasons I could explore that, but it wouldn't be on this platform. And then more modern, more postmodern takes on it have been that Dracula represents, similar to the anti-Semitic sort of allegations, that Dracula represents this racialized other. So he represents a danger to England, which is mainly the sort of the second part of the book. But what I'm reading is in the first, I'm still at the first stages of it, and what I wanted to discuss and go through is a monologue by Dracula himself, which does actually touch on race, but in a slightly different way than the sort of the idea that he is a foreigner going to England and he's going to be subversive and prey on the people. When we're not let that yet there. And I think what's interesting about it is when you put all of this into a larger context, which I'll do. But first, I'm gonna read through this amazing monologue on Dracula, in which he actually gets into ask like the question of race and tribe and ethnicity. So I'll begin, and he says, "We Zakelis have a right to be proud, for in our veins flows the blood of many brave races who fought as the lion fights for lordship. Here in the whirlpool of European races, the Ugric tribe bore down from Iceland the fighting spirit which Thor and Woden gave them, which their berserkers displayed to such fell intent on the seaboards of Europe, aye, and of Asia and Africa too, till the peoples thought that they were wolves themselves had come. Here, too, when they came, they found the Huns, whose warlike fury had swept the earth like a living flame, till the dying peoples heard that in their veins ran the blood of those old witches who, expelled from Scythia, had mated with the devils in the desert. Fools, fools, what devil or what witch was ever so great as Attila, whose blood is in these veins?" He held up his arms. "Is it a wonder that we were a conquering race, that we were proud, that when the Magyar, the Lombard, the Avar, the Bulgar, or the Turk poured his thousands on our frontiers, we drove them back? Is it strange that when Arpad and his legions swept through the Hungarian fatherland, he found us here when he reached the frontier, that the Honfoglalas was completed there? And when the Hungarian flood swept eastward, the Szekelys were claimed as kindred by the victorious Magyars, and to us for centuries was trusted the guarding of the frontier of the Turkey land. Aye, and more than that, endless duty of the frontier guard, for, as the Turks say, water sleeps and the enemy is sleepless. Who more gladly than we throughout the four nations received the bloody sword? Or at its warlike call flocked quicker to the standard of the king, when was redeemed that great shame of my nation, the shame of Cassova, when the flags of the Wallach and the Magyar went down beneath the crescent? Who was it but one of my own race who, as Viviodi, crossed the Danube and beat the Turk on his own ground? This was a Dracula indeed. Woe was it that his own unworthy brother, when he had fallen, sold his people to the Turk and brought the shame of slavery on them. Was it not this Dracula, indeed, who inspired that other of his race who in a later age again and again brought his forces over the great river into Turkey land, and who, when he was beaten back, came again and again and again, though he had come alone from the bloody field where his troops were being slaughtered, since he knew that he alone could ultimately triumph? They said that he thought only of himself. Bah! What good are peasants without a leader? Where ends the war without a brain and heart to conduct it? Again, when after the Battle of Mohacs we threw off the Hungarian yoke, we of the Dracula blood were amongst their leaders, for our spirit would not brook that we were not free. Ah, young sir, the Szekelys and the Draculas, their hearts' blood, their brains and their swords can boast a record that mushroom growths like the Habsburg and the Romanovs can never reach. The warlike days are over. Blood is too precious a thing in these days of dishonourable peace and the glories of the great races, or is a tale that is told. What I thought was so great about this particular passage is that for me it gets right to the heart of what Dracula is all about, and for that matter the romanticism which had largely preceded it. Dracula was written by Bram Stoker in 1897. But before that, in nationalist or right-wing reactionary circles today, there is this fondness for romantic art, the sweeping vistas of wild and untamed lands. And much of that is actually a nostalgic view. So you have the Industrial Revolution in Europe, which sort of reduces man and the resources of the natural world to quantity, to quanta. So it's schematics and it's steamships and it's railroads and it's eventually machine guns and production and consumption, the beginning of it. And the romanticism that we see in the 1800s, which would eventually culminate in Wagner. And you'll notice that there's some crossover with some of the tribes and some of the ideas of Wagner with Dracula's monologue there. They began to look in a pre-industrial, they began to look in this pre-industrial era, before all of that, before machines, before the land was sort of defiled by these abominations of coal and steam production and steel, metal, iron, the churning and the grunting of the production lines and the factories which were springing up everywhere at the time, which were, it had a different effect as well, because it disenchanted the world. It reduced the world. It took the world away from something poetic and metaphysical and spiritual. And it reduced everything to the spreadsheet and to quantity and quantities of materials. It's a material, of course, materialism came in. And I find it interesting that Dracula came in at the end of that era, like literally on the doorstep of 1900, Dracula was published. So leaving aside the other kind of tropes and things with it, what I think so interesting is that here is Dracula speaking to Jonathan Harker in his castle, and Dracula is reminiscing from when he was Vlad the Impaler, of course, at all of these ancient battles. But you will see also that tribe, like it is fundamentally a pre-modern way that Dracula is thinking, because Dracula as a man was actually there. And it was his bloodline who was leading, who was holding the line, as he would saw it, in a world of barbarism. And in a way, when you get into the story, I don't want to get into that too much, but when you get into Vlad the Impaler, it is as if to say, well, we will be more barbaric than the barbarians themselves. And what I think so interesting about this within Dracula is that I've had a theory that as the 1800s and modernity progressed, it became more and more untenable to have this kind of romanticism about the European past. And so what Bram Stoker did was outsource that to Eastern Europe. In Eastern Europe, it would still be a largely unknown. It would still be a world of mysticism and the supernatural, and vampires and werewolves and devils and all of these things, which would kind of the being enlightened in the West. In the West, it was no longer there. But in the Eastern Europe, it was still a place of mystery, and it was still a place where Dracula would come. So eventually, of course, which I'm not going to get into too much today, Dracula will actually enter the new. He will actually go to England. He will actually go into the heart of modernity itself. But where he is here is in his castle, ruminating on this mythological past. And I think it's interesting, I mentioned that so many of the sort of nationalists or reactionaries today have a fondness for romanticism. But you can also see that the way Dracula is talking about nations and tribes, it is within a mythos. It is within this mythological, legendary context. It's just that he himself, Jonathan Harker, doesn't know it. But Dracula himself was actually present. He was literally there, and he, in a way, is kind of lamenting. Well, he's literally lamenting that these age, the age of great battles, the age of heroism, is now long gone. And I often see it when in sort of European national circles today, there's this kind of obsession with genomes and genetics and 23s and me's and all of this kind of thing. And you can see that in this older understanding of identity, that just doesn't play into it at all. That is, in fact, this kind of scientific realism is, in fact, a product of modernity. And I find that Dracula's approach to this, where we have it in a mythological frame, is more powerful and more poetic and more spiritual. If you could say that for somebody such as Dracula, that's the irony, of course. And what you will see is that the liberal sort of frame that we live in, it's kind of negates all of that. And so, in a weird way, all of the people from all over the world will have to also be what I would say is disenchanted. So Dracula's, the way that Dracula is speaking, the way that romanticism approaches this, is this enchantment of the world. It's also why Bram Stoker had to set this elsewhere, had to take it out of the glare of the modern world with its machines, where such things had ran, fled, it was gone. And instead, take it to a place where this still did exist, the dark places of the world where these pre-modern concepts still existed. And the big kind of cope, the big kind of end of history cycle that we are on, is where this should be nowhere in the world should be left like that. And it because it, to put it all of the Western frame, all of modernity will be brought into this sort of disenchanted materialist frame. And when you think of it as well, this actually happened. So today, if the Magyars or the Turks or the Huns, they come, they are themselves brought to the West, and unlike Dracula, they've been shorn of the past. They've been shorn of everything, and they become warehouse staff, call center operatives, and this kind of thing. But Dracula is a relic of the pre-modern world. He is the relic of the enchanted past, the darkness, literally in his case, literally the darkness, which haunts the liberal mind, which haunts the mind of modernity. You think you've disenchanted the world. You think that you've reduced everybody on earth to nothing but consumers, wearing shell suits and leather jackets and jeans. You see it when they step off the boats at Dover. But in actual fact, if you tie all of this in to a cyclical view of history, and you think, well, Dracula is an oddity because he is this relic of a literal dark age, but he's kind of kicking his heels, and you get the sense he's been in his castle for centuries, just bored. And the assumption, of course, is that, well, this is just it now. It's progress forever. But when you put that into the context of a cyclical view of history, you're actually going to see something happen because you're going to see a process wherein, as the cycle goes, the superstitions and the mystical will be chased out under the light of the Enlightenment, the light of liberalism and capitalism and everybody being comfortable and, iPhones and low interest mortgages and careers. And Dracula represents that sneaking its way back in, sneaking its way in at the peak of power, at the very peak of English power in the world in 1897. There's this little element, there's this darkness, which can't really be quantified or reduced to empirical data. And it plays on the conscience because it's still out there. There's still something pre-modern. But then, of course, when you tie that into a cyclical view of history, that is also the future. And so, as the liberal kind of project begins to fall apart at the edges and crack and collapse in on itself, which is where we are now, you are going to see where there'll be more of that. The darkness will come back. And if we go back to Dracula's monologue of barbarism and tribes and, as he would say, as he puts it, the time of legends, the time of blood and warriors and spirit, that isn't actually the deep depths of the past, but it's the future. And perhaps that is the most terrifying thing about Dracula of all. But it's something that I've been thinking about and writing about quite a lot recently, to stare it straight in the face. And we see it every day. We see it on social media. An average user of social media sees depictions of gore and violence and horror happening in their own countries, which would have been unthinkable to somebody like me as a child of the 90s. So gradually, the dark things, the bad things, the barbarians, they come back again. So the status quo in the long, long term of history may well be Dracula's glory years and the unreasoning mind, the irrational mind, the passionate mind. And that's, it seems to me, what the future holds. But when you put it into these kinds of scenes, you can say, well, it's actually nothing new. It's a return to normal, perhaps. But maybe another time we can dig into a little bit of when Dracula actually goes to England and haunts the imagination of modernity. I'll catch you later, folks.